Hello. Welcome to our verse-by-verse in-depth Bible study with Bible teacher Dr. Bob Utley. Now, here's Bob.
We're going to be in Exodus chapter 2 today. This has really got some exciting things in it, I think. I've been amazed in reading Rashi how different Jewish interpretation is from Christian interpretation, and I'll try to mention some of those Jewish ones here and there. I think they're really something. Now, a man from the house of Levi went and married a daughter of Levi. Now, we learn from Exodus chapter 6, verse 20, that his name was Amram, and his wife's name was Jochebed. Now, we also have them named in Numbers 26:59. It mentions that she is his father's sister. So, Amram married his aunt. Now, the rabbis go berserk here. They say she's 130 years old and that God made her beautiful again. And because, see, they're a little nervous about the incestuous relationship here that's forbidden in the book of Leviticus later on. But Leviticus wasn't given yet. This was somewhat common, we know, of these families intermarrying, as we see in the book of Genesis. So, obviously, Amram married a much older lady. But she was not barren. She had two earlier children, of course, we learn. And that would be Miriam, who was the firstborn. We learn her name in Exodus 15:20. And then 3 years before Moses was born, before this edict of Pharaoh, we have Aaron being born. They're introduced a little bit later in the story, of course. Exodus 7:7 is where we learn that Aaron was 3 years older than Moses. So here we have this priestly line, this priestly couple. So Moses is of the tribe of Levi, which would later become a priestly tribe. Not yet, but later would. Okay, and this woman conceived and bore a son. She already had two. And when she saw that he was beautiful, she hid him 3 months. Now, I wonder if that means if he was ugly, she would have put him in the river. I don't know. I've never met a mother yet who had an ugly baby, have you? Now, the rabbis say this means that the Egyptians knew when that Jochebed and Amram had got back together and that Moses was born 3.5 months premature. And that's how she could hide him for 3 months. I don't think any of that's here in the text. Now, notice it says, when he could no longer be hidden, and obviously he was crying too loud at 3 months old, couldn't hide as easily as an infant, she got him a wicker basket. Now, this basket is a unique Egyptian word. Wicker is probably good. It's a papyrus. Now, bulrushes is okay. We're not sure what kind of reed it is, but it's a river reed. We learn from the book of Isaiah, chapter 18, verse 2, that the Egyptians made seagoing ships out of these reeds. And so they were very, later we would be a writing instrument of papyri. So here it's obvious they floated and the basket was to be something that someone would see and say, hey, that's a good basket, I'll take it home. And maybe it's that kind of thing. Well, she put him in a basket and covered it with tar and pitch. And we learn from Genesis 11:3, this is what the same kind of thing probably Noah used on the ark. And 11:3 mentions the tar and pitch they built the Tower of Babel with, they put the bricks together with. So it was something like our bitumen or something, been kind of a black, stinky thing. The rabbis say she put it on the outside so that the baby Moses wouldn't smell it on the inside. Maybe so. Maybe to keep the crocodiles away, I don't know. Covered it with tar and pitch, and then she put the child into it and set it among the reeds. Now here's another Egyptian word. It's the word suf. Now, later in the book of Exodus, Exodus 13:18, this is the very same word that's translated Red Sea. It really should be Sea of Reeds. Now, when we get to that chapter, we'll talk about the different theories for the root of the Exodus. If it's the reeds that grow in fresh water or brackish water, that seems to imply one locale. But from the book of Jonah, this same word, suf, is used for saltwater seaweeds. And so it could very well be the upper part of the Red Sea as we know it today. But we're just not sure, and I'll cover that in detail when I get there. On by the bank of the Nile. This is a unique Egyptian idiom on by the lip of the river. Now, the reason I'm putting this genuine Egyptian words in here is to show you this account is historical. I mean, this really is not made up by some later person. This has Egyptian idioms, Egyptian terms, and so it's obviously a historical account. And his sister stood at a distance to find out what would happen to him. Now, this seems to imply they were planning this. Now, many children, I'm sure, were put in the river. Why? Because in verse 22, they were commanded to. All the Egyptian people would do it. But also, this was a way of kind of exposing the child. Later on In Rome, they'll put them on the garbage heap. It's something like in our day of putting your child on the doorsteps of an orphanage or on the doorsteps of a hospital or the doorstep of a rich family, something like that. And apparently, since Miriam is going to watch, we learn her name from Exodus 15:20, the mother apparently was planning this. Hid the baby in the bulrushes. The Pharaoh's daughter's going to come by. Maybe she came by there every day. The mother's hoping she'll have pity. Here again, we see this wonderful witness that here is God's deliverer that's exposed to the crocodiles and the river and the element, and God's going to save his whole people through this one little baby. Yes, that's a wonderful biblical theme that's repeated in Isaiah and, of course, Matthew and Luke and Mark. And yeah, but it's not a type. It's a type, but it's not an expressed allegory. Now, here we have the idea. Maybe she put him in the reeds so the river current wouldn't take him downstream. Maybe she put him in the reeds so it'd be cooler, it'd kind of shaded from the sun. Maybe she put him in the reeds because that's where Pharaoh's daughter came. Now, watch this. And then the daughter of Pharaoh, if this is Ramesses, which is the son of Ra, the second daughter, he had 59 daughters. Oh, my, what the bathroom must have been like in ancient Egypt early in the morning, huh? Came down to bathe at the Nile. Nile being a river god, maybe it was a religious purpose like the Hindus do in the Ganges River. We're not sure. With her maidens walking alongside the Nile. Now, the rabbis pick up on every little unusual thing in the Hebrew text. And they say these girls were going down there to kill themselves or something. I think it's really far-fetched. Obvious to me, she's going down there with her entourage to bathe. They hear this little baby crying. She sends one of the girls out to get it, comes back. It's a little Hebrew boy. Now, how do they know? Well, maybe the diaper was a such to show it was a Hebrew. Maybe Moses was circumcised in a unique way. Now, we know Egyptians were circumcised, but when and how is the question. So maybe the Hebrews had a unique way of circumcising it, and she saw that. Now, he sure didn't cry in Hebrew, so maybe his hair was cut in a unique way. I just don't know. Maybe the wicker basket idea and knowing the decree to throw the kids in the river was the idea. But she recognizes a Hebrew. And she says that in verse 6. Then his sister said to Pharaoh's daughter. The rabbis here say that they tried to find an Egyptian nurse. But Moses, being holy, wouldn't suckle an Egyptian woman. Oh, yuck. I think this shows something quite else. By the way, I was going to mention to you, in verse 6 it says she saw the child. The literal Hebrew is she saw it, the child. The rabbis say that what she saw was the Shekinah glory in the basket with baby Moses. Makes for a good story. As good as Cecil B. DeMille, isn't it? Now, notice it says then, shall I go and call a nurse for you from the Hebrew women that she shall nurse the child? And Pharaoh's daughter said, go ahead. Now, the Jews would have loved this. Here's a good example of the Hebrews out-tricking the Egyptians. Here Jochebed's going to be paid for nursing her own child. And obviously, these years that she nursed, you say, how long did she nurse him? Well, we know from the ancient world that really a child of 3 or 4 being nursed was not unusual. So maybe that long. And of course, I'm sure all these young years, Jochebed was singing the songs of Zion to this child and telling him about the traditions of Yahweh. I'm assuming that Jochebed is the source of Moses' training, not the Kenite theory of Jethro, the Midianite priest, later on. But I'll discuss that when we get to Jethro. So she nurses it, and Pharaoh's daughter said, take care of this child for me. She's going to adopt it. There's been many speculation about who this Pharaoh's daughter was, and some say this and some say that. But I want to tell you one thing. She was a woman liber, and I guarantee you that. Notice she went against her daddy's order to kill all the Hebrew children. She claims raised this child as her own, obviously without a husband. Boy, she was a strong-willed woman, I want to tell you, defied all the authority. I'm keeping this kid, and if you don't like it, that's tough. And I think we're going to see Pharaoh's attitude toward this child. When Moses finds out to kill an Egyptian, he is immediately tried to be killed by Pharaoh, which so Pharaoh never really accepted this child. That this was a strong-willed daughter and got her will. He grew up in the palace anyway. So the woman took the child home and nursed him. The child grew, and she brought him to Pharaoh's daughter, and he became her son. And she named him Moses and said, because I drew him out of the water. Been a lot of fight here. What does Moses mean? Well, it could come from the participial form of a Hebrew word to draw out of. And that seems to be the popular etymology that's recorded in the last part of verse 10. But the question comes, would an Egyptian Pharaoh's daughter use a Hebrew name for a child? Maybe so, because the child was Hebrew. But it seems to me much more logical if the word Moses has an Egyptian origin instead of a Hebrew origin. Now, we know from the term Tutmosis, son of Thoth. And we know from the term Ramesses, son of Ra, that Moses, spelled in several different ways, can mean son of. So that seems to be the Egyptian background. And maybe there is a sound pun, which the Hebrews love to do, on I drew him out of the river, and also on son of. And so maybe this dual aspect. Now, between verses 10 and 11, and I picked this up in a little book that I just love so much. I really like the Zondervan Bible Study Guide series. And a friend of mine from Southwestern Seminary, Dr. Huey, mentions that between verses 10 and 11 is assumed a 40-year period. And between verse 22 and 23 is assumed a 40-year period. Much about the early life of Moses, as far as his internal motives, we learn not from this account in Exodus, but from Stephen's speech in Acts chapter 7, and from the book of Hebrews, particularly chapter 11, we learn some of at least the interpretation of Moses' inner motives. And since I believe that New Testament's inspired, then I, of course, accept that. We don't learn all of that from here, but we pick up a lot from the New Testament. So the reason I said that is the New Testament divides Moses' life into three 40-year periods. 40 years with Pharaoh, 40 years in the desert, 40 years with the children of Israel. And so he was academically prepared and experientially prepared for his task that God called him to. Now, verse 11. Now, it came about in those days when Moses had grown up. You might want to see Acts 7:23, says 40 years old, that he went out to his brothers and looked upon their hard labors. Now, the term went out to his brothers and looked upon, this is a term that means to look on with great emotion, to look on with great empathy. Somehow he knew that he was a Hebrew and not an Egyptian. Either his Pharaoh adopted mother had told him, or he had learned it from Miriam and his mother, who may have kept in contact some way. But he knew who he was. Now, some say, the rabbis begin to say here, he felt a divine call and mission to deliver his people. Even some Christian commentators who are nervous about Moses killing somebody say he did it because of God's command. Now, it seems to me that he is going to try to deliver his people, or at least to help them. It's kind of like Abraham trying to help God by taking Hagar, his wife's Egyptian handmaiden. Moses is going to try to do maybe what he felt God wanted him to do, but in his own strength, and it's going to issue in a disaster. That seems to be the predetermined plan of God, that he has 40 years desert experience before he takes the children back to the same area and helps them live 40 years there. But anyway, even though it was in the plan of God, how do you explain Moses killing somebody in God's name, right? That's been a real problem. And so the rabbis take it one way and most Christian commentators take it another. This becomes a big issue in Augustine's books on morals, as does the lying earlier. Now, he saw an Egyptian beating a Hebrew, one of his brothers. Now, we learn from Hebrews 11, 24 and 25, gives us insight into this. He felt the call of God. The rabbis here say that, well, they go into an elaborate deal, that there was a Hebrew slave and there was an Egyptian taskmaster, and the taskmaster wanted to make love to the Egyptian slave's wife, so he sent the slave out to work all day, and the slave knew what was happening, so the Egyptian taskmaster broke into his home and seduced his wife by force, and he came home and saw her, and the Egyptian taskmaster started beating him and beat him all day, and Moses knew that and killed him because of that. They're trying to justify Moses' murder, what they're trying to do. Now, notice it says, and so he looked this way and that, and when he saw there was no one around. Now notice Moses knew this is premeditated murder. He's looking around to make nobody sees it, and he struck down the Egyptian. Now the Egyptian was beating a Hebrew slave, but here's an intensification. He kills the Egyptian. Now probably hand-to-hand combat was a regular part, the physical training was a regular part of the Egyptian young princes. And so he had the best karate training available in his day, and boy, he whackoed this Egyptian with it right here. And hid him in the sand, obviously a shallow grave there. And went out the next day, and behold, two Hebrews were fighting with each other. And he said to the offender, that legally, this is the idea of who's the one that caused the problem and who's the one that's being hurt, you know. Why are you striking your companion? But he said to him, who, the one who was in the wrong, who made you a prince or a judge over us? Are you going to kill us as you kill the Egyptian? Now, notice this. The Hebrews, first of all, said, who put you in charge? They also said, are you going to treat us like you did that poor Egyptian? Now, boy, what is the deal here? Well, remember when Moses starts saying, now, God, I don't want to deliver them. I'm not a good speaker. And when they say, who sent me, who will I say? Moses had a bad taste in his mouth about trying to help his own people. his own people. Now the Jews say, well, Moses was afraid not because of Pharaoh, but because of his, there were tattletales or spies among his own people who would tell Pharaoh, and that hurt him, and he just said, well, I'll just leave because my people aren't worthy of deliverance. There's two ways to interpret it. One trying to justify Moses' acts. The other just saying, well, this is just a record of what happened. Another saying, no, it was a predetermined plan of God that Moses knew. I think it's just a record of what happened, not advocating or condemning, just telling us what happened. Now, Moses became afraid and said, surely the matter has become known. And when Pharaoh heard of this matter, he tried to kill Moses. Now, that shows me that Pharaoh, you normally wouldn't kill a prince for killing just another person. You might slap his hand, but you wouldn't kill him. This shows, I think, that Pharaoh had premeditated plans that at the first opportunity to get rid of Moses. And this was a legal chance to do it. And maybe Moses knew the Pharaoh was against him, and boy, he hooked him, I want to tell you. Went to the land of Midian. You say, now, where is that? A good question. And who are the Midianites? Good question. We learn from parts of Genesis that they seem to be of the descendants of Cain. I believe it's Genesis 25:2. Midian's a child of Abraham by Keturah, Genesis 25:2. But also the name is linked to the Kenites, which goes back to the line of Cain. And so, my goodness, we get all kinds of things in here. Was he a Kenite or a Midianite? Or is, are those two different names for the same tribe or two different tribes of the same name? I must admit I'm not sure. Many people are going to make a big deal out of this because they're going to say the Midianites also worshipped Yahweh. And Moses really learned about Yahweh from this high priest of Midian, Jethro, also called Jether, also called Reuel, also called Hobab. When that guy filled out the IRS form, it was a mess, I want to tell you. Three different names for sure, and two different ways of spelling one of them are in the Bible for him. You can look at your notes and see where all these scripture passages are on the different names. Reuel means shepherd of God, and the other ones have different names, different meanings. Now, he was a priest of Midian. Again, where is Midian? Well, if you look at the map of the Promised Land, the Arabian Desert just to the east, all the way down the Sinai Peninsula is places we found Midianites. Now, Midianites later become major enemies of Israel. So it's highly unusual. This would be written later in Israel's history because the Midianites become major enemies. So it shows the historicity that at this point they're good, they're friendly. Now, they're nomadic people, so they could be down the Sinai area or they could be over in the Arabian area. And where they are, we're just not sure. I really think the burning bush is going to be on Mount Sinai and that God's going to say, bring them back to this mountain. And so I think it's in the southern Sinai Peninsula is where Jethro was watering his flocks. Now, he's a priest of Midian, had seven daughters, kind of a perfect number. They had a bunch of daughters in that day, and that's unusual. Pharaoh had so many, and then here Jethro has so many. And they came to draw water and fill the troughs with water for their father's flocks. Today, still, in Israel and Arab countries, women water the flocks, not the men. So there's a historical account there, of course. And the shepherds came down and drove them away. The men who were shepherding the sheep wouldn't let these women water their flocks because this water is scarce until they had watered their own. Now, Moses must have been, I think he was a pretty strong physical specimen. I think he had a lot of training physically in Pharaoh's court. And he put the bite on these shepherds, ran them off, and helped them women water. Now, why? Was he such a compassionate person? Was he looking for a home? Did he spy one of these seven daughters and fall in love with her? Well, we don't know. But that's happened so often in the book of Genesis, it wouldn't surprise us, would it? Remember Rachel was a shepherdess when Jacob saw her? Now, notice there it mentions then that he helped these girls. They watered the flock. They came to Reuel, which means shepherd of God. That's interesting in a shepherding context here. And said, why have you come back so soon? Obviously, every day this happened. The shepherds ran them off and watered their flocks first, and the girls had to wait and then water late and get home late. And the dad said, what are you doing home so early? They said, an Egyptian delivered us from the hand of the shepherds. Now, Moses talked like an Egyptian, acted like an Egyptian, dressed like an Egyptian. They didn't know anything else. He's an Egyptian, okay? An Egyptian shaved a whole lot. Hebrews didn't. So obviously Moses was clean shaven and was wearing, I'm sure, the probably still the royal robes he fled in, right? What is more, he even drew the water for us. Now, that's highly unusual. Why would he do that? Sign of friendship, sign of favor, wanting to endear himself to a family? We don't know, but it was highly unusual for a man to draw water. Only the women did that usually. All of the shepherds would do it for their own flocks. Okay. And he said to his daughters, well, where is this fella? And they said, well, we left him at the well. And dad said, are you crazy? You know, in the Orient, there's a real order of etiquette. And these girls had violated that etiquette, although it would have been unfair for them to invite this man home. The father says, go get him and invite him to have dinner with us and thank him for helping. And so Moses stayed there and said to his daughters, where is he? Why has he left the man behind? Invite him to have something to eat. Look at verse 21. And Moses was willing to dwell with the man, and he gave him his daughter. Now, the word Zipporah means a little bird, maybe a little, some say a wobbler. Some say she chirped all the time. She was a chirper. I prefer the little bird idea. And so Moses was given a woman and stayed there, and apparently was ready to settle down with this man, this priest of Midian. Now, let's see. And when she gave birth to a son and called him Gershom. Now, Gershom seems to be from a Hebrew root that means a foreigner or a sojourner, and that seems to fit. All the names of the Bible are puns on the sounds, not technical etymologies of the roots of the words. And so here is Gershom, and I think it shows a little psychological insight that Moses knew he was a foreigner, recognized he was away from home, felt alienated and estranged. So had his forebearers who were in the call of God. They were also sojourners in a foreign land. So is Moses. Okay, look at verse 23. By the way, it seems to be a 40-year period between verses 22 and 23. Now, Moses had the academic training necessary to record the truth of God. He went to the MIT of his day, Pharaoh's court. Stayed there 40 years in training. My, what an education. Now he's going to stay 40 years in the very desert where the children of Israel are going to wander. He's going to know the water holes. Going to know what to do for sunburn. Know how to treat snake bite. Know how to keep animals alive. God's preparing this man. So apparently between 22 and 23 is 40 more years. Now it came about in the course of those many days that the king of Egypt died. Now many of us think this refers to Seti the First. And you say, well, you mean God's people were under this heavy load for 40 years? Yes. Yes. Now it's very important we see the rest of this chapter. God was working something out in history. God is not in a hurry. But God's not late either, friends. He knew what was happening to his people. He had prepared a way to deliver them, but he was preparing his deliverer. Now, I think Seti the First died, and Ramses the Second just became Pharaoh. And the sons of Israel sighed because of their bondage, and they cried out, and their cry for help because of their bondage rose up to God. This is going to be the very same way that Exodus chapter 3 starts. They're crying to God, and God's hearing. But listen to this next. Verse 24 and 25 show us very clearly the heart of God. Friends, even though you may have prayed, you wonder why God's not acting, wonder why things have gone on so long, wonder why you've been sick so many years, why your loved one's been sick. I want to tell you, God is acting. God is doing. Things are coming to a culmination. But folks, we're so used, in America, we've got this consumer attitude. We're used to getting something packaged and we rip it open and consume it and are satisfied. God's not a fast-paced God. He's doing things appropriately by working through men and women in circumstances. Notice what it says. So God heard their groanings. God remembered his covenant with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. God saw the sons of Israel, and God knew them. Knew meaning Genesis 4:1. Adam knew Eve, and she conceived. The relationship between God and his people is not one of knowledge, not one of rules, but one of intimate relationship. And the intimate relationship issues in knowledge, theology, issues in rules, lifestyle. So there is a covenant relationship, but the covenant relationship is informed and energized by personal faith. Now listen to this. God saw their problems, and he had already been working on it. But they prayed, and God responded. Now Moses wasn't quite ready. God had to get the historical situation ready. God had to get Moses ready. God had to get his own people. They had rejected Moses' leadership earlier. God, 40 years of hard labor, they were ready for anybody to help them. History is coming together. Now, if you look at history in a textbook, you just see what seems to be haphazard nations coming to power and losing power. But folks, you look at the Bible, you see that history is on track. For the purposes of redemption. History is on track in the hands of an all-powerful God. History is on track, moving toward a day when God, through Jesus Christ, will judge the living and the dead. We see that as we move through history, God is trying to redeem all the nations by His blessing of the covenant people, and then uniquely of the Messiah. Look at these verbs. He heard, He remembered, He saw, He knew. And I want to say this. Notice that God's help is put in the context of the covenant relationship with Abraham. God told Abraham back in Genesis 15:16 that his people or descendants would be taken into Egypt and be captive there, but that God would bring them out with a mighty hand and they would receive the promised land because the sin of the Amorite wasn't quite full yet. God told Abraham all that was going to happen, and He shows how it is happening in history now. It shows the sovereignty of God in history. My friend, I don't know what you're going through. I don't know all the suffering you have. I don't know how much you worry about world events. But from the biblical record, God is sovereign. God's in control of the destiny of nations. God's in control of the destiny of individuals. Now, I don't believe it's a puppet show. I don't believe in determinism. I do believe in election. I do believe in foreknowledge. I do believe in predestination. You do have a choice, but thanks be unto God, God's involved in the overarching plan and in the daily actions of every human being called by His name. We see it here in Moses. And because we know the Bible was written for all believers, you know in your life, God's involved. Don't grow weary in well-doing. Don't give up. Don't become bitter. I know we go through hard times, but friends, the hard times is what molds us into the people of God. The hard times is what makes us more like His Son. The hard times is what keeps us united to Him. Oh, friend, God's in control. God cares for you. Hang in there. It will be worth it all when we see Him. Nothing just happens to God's children. People are being prepared to help. It may be you. Have a good day.